This is Just Women, every Tuesday at 1 o'clock on Brooklyn's Radio.
Our final guest is Claire Edwards. Claire, before we talk about your current role, can you just tell us a little bit about your career background? What's brought you to this point?
Yes, of course. I'm a registered nurse by profession and trained at Guy's Hospital in London more years ago than I care to admit to, and have had quite a number of years working in clinical settings, hospitals and so on, across the NHS and the private sector. And then about 17 years ago, I joined a UK-wide company of independent care advisors who do exactly that. They provide independent care advice for older people and their families. I made the decision at the end of 2016 to create my own company, Claire Edwards Elder Care Consultant, when my husband was diagnosed with cancer. And I wanted to sort of rein in my work-life balance, if you like. And so here I am 18 months later, wishing I'd done it 10 years ago. I've really enjoyed the journey, which has been terrifying and exciting in equal measure.
Obviously, the catalyst was partly your husband.
Yeah.
But what was the need for you to want to do this? Is it because you recognised there was a demand, or what was it that made you want to do
it? There is undoubtedly a demand, but I think anybody who's been working for the same organisation for 16, 17 years is bound to start to get itchy feet, I think. I'm of an age where I was thinking if I'm going to make any changes, probably now is the time to do it. And I think whilst my husband's diagnosis wasn't the only cause, it was certainly one of the many factors that actually encouraged me to make the move.
And who are your clients? Is it sort of NHS or sort of organisations, or is it private individuals?
It's private individuals. So I'm most commonly contacted by concerned sons and daughters or other family members of an older person who needs support. But I also provide services to clients who come to me through their financial advisor or their solicitor. So, of course, not all older people have got family. It's a very sad fact that there are older people out there without family representation, and their solicitor and their financial advisor may be the person who recognises the need for support and will put them in contact with me.
So what is the biggest demand, do you feel? Is it to find the right sort of care home or nursing home? Is it more around the legal side? What sort of areas do you find people are struggling with?
Yeah, well, all of that, really. I mean, that's the thing with health and social care for older people. It's such a broad subject, and families just don't know where to start. I typically say that I help older people and their families to navigate the NHS and social services, because the people who contact me don't generally know who they should be speaking to and what questions they should be asking. It sounds perhaps a little bit daft, but not everybody understands what their needs are. Needs are broken down into sort of three sectors, if you like: personal care, social care and nursing care. And it's understanding really the what those needs are and what skill is required to meet those needs, and what is the most suitable setting for those needs to be met in. So finding the right, understanding the needs and understanding the options is a very big part of what I do, as indeed is who is going to fund the care. Sure. That's enormous for a lot of people.
So what are the big differences between personal care and social care?
Okay, so personal care is helping somebody to get washed and dressed, helping to take them to the toilet, making sure that they have got food in the fridge, there's somebody there to cook it for them and perhaps help them with feeding at a fairly low level. Social care is making sure that the individual has got social contact, that they're not becoming socially isolated and lonely. And loneliness is a very, very big topic for a lot of older people.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I was looking at your blog posts earlier on, and obviously there are, you know, lots of issues that you address. I mean, the one that sort of really caught my eye was a letter from a carer of a husband with dementia. Mm. And you sort of talk about loneliness. You know, you can be lonely in a house of two people, can't you, if you're the carer? Mm. And I guess every single circumstance is different. So are you literally going into the home and sort of assessing a situation, or you?
Yes, and in fact, that's interesting that you should have picked that particular blog, because one of the difficulties for older people is their age. They are suffering from often multiple medical conditions, and they are propping each other up. You know, as a society, we expect an awful lot of older spouses. It's quite common to have a couple where one is mentally able and physically in need, and the other is the other way around. And it's not until one of them sadly passes away that actually the needs of the other becomes apparent to the family. I think one of the difficulties for couples who are struggling to cope with dementia and are living with dementia is that when you get to the advanced stages of the condition, it is like a bereavement but without closure, because the person you married is not the person who you are living with anymore, and you don't have that closure, that opportunity to move on. And nor does that spouse necessarily want to, but it just completely changes the dynamics of the relationship.
Do you think one of the problems with particularly dementia is the person that's got it accepting they actually have it? Because if you don't accept you've got it, it's very hard to accept help.
It's a really...
Especially for the partner.
Yes, it is. It's a really fascinating, if that's the right word, condition. And I see older people, and well, in fact, younger people too, who have dementia. But of course, dementia is a journey. You know, you start off with the early stages and it gradually develops, and the rate at which it develops differs hugely depending on which type of dementia you have and with the individual and what other health conditions they have. But they do struggle. They undoubtedly struggle with that. Early stages, of course, when the older person does appreciate that they've got difficulties, that must be so hard, so hard for them, coming to terms with the condition that they have and knowing that there is no cure for it. It must be absolutely devastating.
But I think for the people that don't want to admit it or don't want other people around to know they've got it, it must be so hard trying to mask it all, trying to carry on as if everything's okay. That must be a strain in itself, maybe in a way, by just saying, actually, I have got it and accepting it. That might release the stress and anxiety.
Yes, and I think if you put yourself in the shoes of the person who's living with dementia, it must be absolutely terrifying. And I think that's often the case with all sorts of different disabilities, is that terrible sense of losing control over how you live your life and what support you are going to receive. And it is so important to not lose sight of that and make sure that the support you provide is given in a way that is acceptable and palatable to that person with a disability, because it's very frustrating feeling that you're losing control of your life and how you conduct it.
Yeah, and I you know, if you're going through that, you know, it's scary enough in itself, but then to have a lot of strangers sort of coming into the house possibly and sort of being involved in your care to, you know, whatever degree, must be very, very difficult.
Yes, I mean, anxiety and depression are often very prevalent features in people who are living with dementia. And, of course, that's not altogether surprising, really. They do need a huge amount of support. But one of the difficulties in getting that support to the person who's having difficulty coming to terms with their diagnosis is that they are missing out on opportunities to receive support, whether that be through the community mental health team, the memory clinic, the GP, and indeed support for the carer. All of those levels of support are out there, but you, as the person with dementia or your carer, have got to put your hand up and not be afraid to talk about it.
Do you think that, you know, in Great Britain, by contrast to, say, some of the European countries, I'm thinking of Italy and Spain, where, you know, all the family, you know, the extended family all live close together often and are involved in each other's lives, that in Great Britain, you know, couples where one's got dementia, they're very sort of closed in and they don't really sort of share it with the wider family, and it becomes an issue that they just try and deal with when really they should be reaching out. Are you seeing that?
That's a difficult one for me to answer, because I can only base my conversation on my own experience of what I see. I just know that the pressures on all generations of a family are enormous, whether it's dementia that is the disability or whether it is a physical disability.
Yeah.
The pressures are enormous. And one of the other blogs, in fact, on my website talks about the sandwich generation. And obviously we're not alone in this. European countries have the same scenarios where you've got a generation of people in their middle age who are the sandwich generation trying to support an older person with a disability, with a condition. But they've also got children at the other end as well. So yeah. They're queuing in IKEA for the pots and pans for university one moment and then dashing round to make sure that mum or dad has had something to eat the next, as well as trying to hold down a full-time job. The pressures are huge and it's absolutely vital that people do put their hand up and say, actually, I'm struggling, and that they talk about it to their friends and their family. It's vital, absolutely vital that they receive that support.
So are you an advocate or a networker, someone that sort of is in the middle and would signpost, go to this organ? Because obviously you can't be all things to all people.
No.
So would you go in and assess the situation and then decide what care is needed or what support's needed and then signpost them?
Yes, absolutely. Well, I provide a number of different services which are there to see on my website. But typically the starting point would be a consultation visit where I would meet with the older person and their family to understand their health conditions and look at the impact that's having on their ability and quality of life, but really, really importantly, to understand their needs and wishes. It's very easy for somebody who is trying to support an individual who needs care to think they know best and they think they know how to care for them. But listening to that older person with or without dementia is absolutely crucial, because understanding their personal wish list and their personal criteria is vital to getting the right care solution for them that is sustainable and isn't then going to cause a deterioration in their mental health.
Presumably, you know, one of the reasons you started your business, this is a growing problem, isn't it, with an elderly generation that's growing.
It is. And I think one of the sad things is that we are blessed in this country with fabulous institutions, the NHS and the local authority. But the problem is one of funding.
Yeah.
I think everybody recognises that care is costly. And the local authorities and NHS are really struggling to meet the needs of a growing population and our ageing population are not ageing well. They have multiple conditions, mental and physical health conditions, which are impacting on their ability and their quality of life.
But I suppose also people are living longer, aren't they?
So yes, living longer but not necessarily in good health.
Exactly.
It's the quality of life, isn't it? I don't know what the life expectancy was even sort of 20 years ago, but probably quite a bit less than now, I don't know.
I suppose with technology and science and movements forward.
Well, that's right. I mean, obviously our hospitals are doing fabulous work and, you know, treatment for conditions is progressing all the time, so people are living longer.
Living longer, but, yeah, as I say, sort of lower quality of life. I mean, another blog post that I read earlier is hospital to residential care, you know, the shock. People are in hospital maybe for longer than they sort of expected to be, and suddenly they're not going back home, they can't go back home. And that, I mean, are you helping to manage people?
Yes,
in
that situation? That particular blog was written very soon after I'd been supporting somebody in their discharge from hospital into a care home. And I was really struck by how alone she was in many ways. She did have family, she did have friends, but it was a very, very difficult decision. It wasn't a decision she made lightly. And just the whole prospect, you know, we all talk about moving home being one of the most stressful things that you can do, but to effectively move home in those circumstances must be so tough.
Yeah.
And she had real difficulties communicating with people outside of the hospital who were trying to support her. I was just really struck by how very sad that was. But thankfully, with the support that I was able to give her, with her family members and with the professionals that were involved in that particular case, we were able to find her the right home for her, and she has settled there very well.
Something I found from evidence from like friends who've got elderly relatives as well is that sometimes the hospitals will send a person home, an elderly person home, without any support at all. And a friend of mine's mum had a broken leg, and they wanted to send her home at 3 a.m. to her home without anyone there to help her.
Yeah, I mean,
I find astonishing.
I can't think of any circumstances when sending somebody home at 3 o'clock in the morning is acceptable level. I think something to think about, though, is that if an older person is in hospital and they want to go home and they have got mental capacity to make that decision, they can't be held there against their wishes. They must be supported in their desire to go home. And this is a really big factor across so many cases that I support, is remembering that if the older person has got mental capacity to make those decisions, they must be supported to make those decisions and help fulfil them. If they don't have mental capacity to make those decisions, they must be supported and decisions made on their behalf made absolutely in their best interests. And when you're deciding what's in somebody's best interests, you do really have to think very carefully about what their known wishes were before they lost capacity.
Yeah.
These are really, really important points.
And I guess that then you bring in the issue of enduring power of attorney. Do you then go to a close relative, or maybe there isn't anybody that's got that? I mean, do you then have to sort of make that decision for them?
That's right. I mean, one of the messages I'd like to get across really today is the importance of thinking ahead and how vital it is to consider power of attorney arrangements, both for property and finance and health and welfare decisions. Because if you don't appoint somebody that you trust to make those decisions for you and you later lose capacity, you can't have those attorneyships set up on your behalf. You have to do it yourself. It makes it incredibly difficult for those that are supporting you to act on your behalf if those powers aren't in place. If you are without a lasting power of attorney for property and finance, for example, and there are funds there to be managed, it's necessary for the family or closest representatives to approach the Court of Protection for deputyship. And that is a very costly and takes a lot of time to actually set up. Mm. Without a health and welfare power of attorney, you are dependent on health and social care professionals that are responsible for your care arrangements to make decisions in your best interest. So there is a system there to support people, but it's having that complete control over how you are supported and making sure that your known wishes are expressed and documented somewhere.
You mentioned on your website, Claire, about the 7-point plan to finding the right care.
Yes.
Can you mention some of those points that people should look out for?
We've touched on some of them already, but clearly understanding what the needs are is a really important starting point. Understanding what the care options are, how am I going to be supported? That is most likely going to be in your own home to start with, but then there are other levels of support to be had in sheltered housing, which comes in all different shapes and sizes now. And then, of course, residential and nursing home accommodation. Once you've found your right care option, you've then got to find the right provider of that care option. Also, how is this going to be funded? This is a really big topic, particularly, given that care is costly and we know that local authority and NHS budgets are very tight. So one of the really important roles that I play is helping people to making sure that people are getting the financial support they're entitled to from the statutory services. So from the local authority, the Department of Work and Pensions and the NHS. There comes a point with both the legal aspects and the financial aspects, of course, where there's a line in the sand that I can't cross over because I am neither a financial advisor or a legal advisor. And I will very happily signpost my clients to appropriate legal and financial advice if that is what's required.
Mm. And continuing care, that's an option, isn't it? That I don't know if many people are really aware of how that even works.
Yeah, I'm not sure I would describe it as an option.
Well,
it's a source of funding, certainly. Yes, yeah. NHS continuing healthcare funding is worth a lot of money.
Yeah.
It is paid to people who've been assessed as having a primary health need, which you would think would apply to most residents in nursing homes the length and breadth of the country. It's not awarded based on a specific diagnosis. It's awarded following a very, very detailed assessment of need, which looks at 11 different care domains, which include, for example, nutrition, mobility, continence, and so on. But it also looks at the characteristics of the care that's required. So the nature of the condition, the unpredictability of the care needs, the complexity and the intensity. This is a very specific language that's used in the context of continuing healthcare funding. And it's really important that families go into that process from an informed perspective if they are going to be successful in their application.
And typically, how long would that take from putting in the first application to, you know?
It's a lengthy process. Yeah. The assessment is two-stage, the first being something called an NHS Continuing Healthcare Checklist, which is a tick-box exercise which helps to filter out people who are clearly not going to be eligible at all.
Yeah.
And then the second stage is leads up to a decision support tool assessment and meeting, which is a very in-depth assessment process. It does take a lot of time. I know that across Surrey there are long waiting lists for assessments. You know, they run into many weeks delay in getting these conducted.
And in the meantime, people are just sort of waiting in hospital? Or, I mean, is that the situation while you're waiting for your
No, you don't necessarily have to be remaining in hospital while the assessment process takes place. The important thing is that you are in the system.
Yeah.
It is, you know, you go home or you go into your care home, wherever it is that's the most suitable setting for you. And your care will either be funded by local authority or by private purse. And in due course, obviously, reflection will be given on what should be paid back because it's been awarded, or possibly not, of course.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely.
It's a minefield, isn't it? It really
absolutely
is.
Yeah. I mean, unfortunately, Claire, we are sort of fast approaching the time to end our chat now. So, you know, just to sort of finish off, is there any sort of particular advice that you would like to sort of give? I mean, is that sort of...
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think it's really, really important that people think ahead. Don't wait for the crisis to take advice, because if you wait until you've got a crisis, your options shrink. So think ahead. Do bear in mind that if you are starting to struggle, there are often quite a number of preventative measures that can be taken that will help reduce the risk of that crisis happening at all.
Okay, that's really good advice. Thank you very much. And if anyone wanted to get in touch with you, best way via your website?
Yes, or call me direct on my mobile number, 07415 387129, or drop me an email at ce@eldercareconsultant.co.uk. Both of those are on the website, clearly.
Thank you very much, Claire. It's been really interesting chatting with you, and I can think of numerous people that could probably sort of use your services right now, actually. You know, as you say, we're all in this sort of sandwich generation.
You're listening to Just Women on Brooklands Radio. You can join in by emailing any comments or questions you may have to justwomen@brooklandsradio.co.uk, or check us out on Facebook. Search for Just Women at Brooklands Radio. Just Women is just what you need.